I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 14th of June. Today, the White House Council on Women and Girls, along with the State Department, the Department of Labor, the Aspen Institute, and Civic Nation, is convening the first ever United States of Women's Summit in Washington. It's going to celebrate success made to advance gender equality at home and abroad and to chart a course for work that remains. People who work in both domestic and international arenas will gather to highlight key issues affecting women and girls. And the issues are economic empowerment, health and wellness, educational opportunity, violence against women, entrepreneurship and innovation, leadership and civic engagement. 5,000 people will be attending. We'll talk about the many issues on the agenda today with Professor Virginia Sapiro. She's a professor of political science at Boston University and has published extensively in the fields of political psychology, political behavior and public opinion, gender politics, and feminist and democratic theory. She is a former UW-Madison professor. Professor Sapiro, thanks very much for being with us.
Hello. It's very nice to join you.
Nice
to
have
you back in Wisconsin.
Good. Good to have you back in Wisconsin. This is a huge conference. 5,000 people?
That's pretty amazing. I've got to say that what was very surprising to me is I hadn't actually heard of it, so there must be the other 5,000 women other than you and me. But once I looked it up, there's just a fabulous array of leaders in all sorts of different areas.
Mm-hmm.
And, looks like they'll have a good chance to have some good conversation and discussion.
Yeah, I hadn't heard anything about it either until our producer found out about it. Let's start with women in office who are influencing public policy and hopefully crafting public policy. This is your area. These figures are still pretty sad. This is from the material from the conference. In 2012, 62.3% of women voted, but they are less than 25% of the Senate, 20% of the House, 12% of governors, only 25% of state legislators. Why is that?
You ought to add one more. 43 other countries have already had a woman head of government or state, and we haven't managed that yet.
Mm-hmm.
How come? We do look pretty bad. In some of those, we've finally gotten up almost to the middle of the pack, and some of those we are further behind. The ones that are ahead of us are a really mixed lot. In the first days, it was mostly the Nordic countries, Sweden and Denmark, and those that seem to be ahead of us. But now it's all sorts of different countries that have done better. There are a lot of explanations for that, but one of them is that there are a lot of countries where people have paid attention to that kind of thing as part of what they discuss when they discuss representation. And we certainly have some people here who do that, but we haven't necessarily paid a lot of attention. The barriers to running for office are pretty high. We're a geographically very large country, so if you're going to join a national office, it means moving very, very far away from home. And it may still be the case that women are less likely to do that to their families than men are. There are even some studies I recall seeing that within given states, that the closer women's communities are to the state capital, the more likely they are to be in office. Because, again, they, for a whole variety of reasons, they may disrupt their family life a little less than men do when they get interested in politics. So, a lot of barriers. We require more money and funding than anywhere else to run for office. This year's going to be our most expensive one thus far. So, a lot of things.
I wonder how much of it is still tied up to the fact that women do the great majority of child caring in this country. When you look at the gap in pay, women are making $39,700 compared to men $50,400, the median wage. When you look at the women who do not have children, the figure is much higher than that. They're making much more money. You look at child care costs, you look at the lack of paid sick leave, the lack of family leave for a huge number of American workers. Do you think all of that ties into women finding it very difficult to take jobs that will take them far away from home?
I think it's partly then and partly the time. Once upon a time, you know, back in the olden days, I remember when people would talk about women not being able to do these things because they were taking care of their children. But that was before the vast majority of women were in the workforce.
Right.
And the issue underlying a lot of what you were just talking about is nowadays, most research still shows that women do the, if they have children, they're doing the majority of the childcare and they're doing the majority of the other domestic work. But also, most are in the labor force. And as you say, they are not earning as much as men. And compared with the other major wealthy and democratic countries, we are way behind in offering support for parental leave and care. And that means there's a limit to what women might be able to take on board when you put all that together. So it's difficult to do other things where you really commit yourself to having to be there. You know, you don't have those kind of resources.
One of the areas the conference will be looking at is paid family leave. 90%, almost 90% of American workers don't have access to paid family leave. We must be among very few countries in this world that don't have paid family leave.
This is true. In the OECD, which is an international federation of most of the countries we'd want to be identified with, plus some we may not, we are one of the few that offers no federally, you know, nationally funded leave. We do have allowance for family leave. That was the first bill, H.R. 1, actually, by President Bill Clinton, was about family leave. But ours is unpaid, and so you have to be pretty wealthy to be able to afford to take that time off. You know, a lot of people say we can't afford it. You know, other countries that aren't as wealthy as us seem to be able to afford it, and also it has a lot to do with the quality of our family lives, and we're supposed to be very pro-family. So, a lot of people would say we're pretty behind on that, too.
Why is that? What is it about America that makes that very difficult to enact? Because it affects almost everybody.
It does affect everybody, and I guess I'd go in two directions. One is that the American population is, despite the size of our welfare state, is very wary of those kinds of what people call entitlements sometimes, or social welfare, safety net, much more wary than other, you know, similar kinds of countries. So there are a lot of those kinds of things that we don't do. And the other is, and this goes to something you just said, people see this as a very particularistic thing. They call it a women's issue. Now, let's hold for aside a moment for the fact that women are the majority of the population. But they say it's a women's thing. And as long as it's not seen as a family thing, a child thing, a population thing, then it's seen as particular and, quote, special interest. And so there are a number of reasons why we've been much slower than other places.
Mm-hmm. The other area, and I don't know how other countries in the world compare to us in this regard, but I was reading this statistic that the average family will pay $10,000 a year in child care expenses, which is a huge amount of money, particularly for those who are, and there are many in this category, not making that much money in this country. It seemed to me, I remember years and years ago doing talk shows on all the companies in America that were going to be offering child care, and companies were going to collaborate with each other to offer a central child care place that was close to where everybody worked. None of that seemed to have materialized.
$10,000 sounds good if you're sitting in a city like I am in Boston. There are companies that have done that. I just had a meeting recently at the great bioscience company, Biogen, in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and I was fascinated to see as I walked into my meeting on the ground floor, there was just a beautiful little child care center and a fabulous park. and I saw mothers and fathers there taking time off from, you know, work, being able to go over and play with them, take a little, you know, instead of a coffee break, go over there. So there are companies that have done that sort of thing, but not a huge number. It's probably a good time also to remind all of us that there's still a very large number of corporations in the United States that have no women in the C-suite or on the corporate boards, or have maybe one and feel good about it. And while it's in men's interest too, and a lot of men are just fabulous supporters of these kinds of things, it tends to be a little more, you need women around to really raise the issue and see it as a priority. It's not cheap.
No, it's not cheap.
It's a big expense, and our, you know, our companies are, they're always making hard choices, and they face a tough international economy. But again, you know, there are reasons why this just hasn't seemed to be a priority.
You would think, and you do hear reports from time to time of companies who have done wonderful child care programs, family leave programs, and it just creates this loyal, happy workforce.
It does create loyalty. And, you know, I can say being in an extremely expensive city, and I just spent the last 8 years as a dean at Boston University, and trying to hire wonderful young faculty, as everybody does across the country. Some of the biggest barriers had to do with figuring out work life, family life, child care,
right,
schools, balancing all those kinds of things. And young workers who are very desirable, and here I mean men and women, young workers who are very desirable, take this into account when they figure out where they want to be employed.
Mm-hmm. So how much is child care in Boston?
Oh, gosh. Luckily for me, my child is 31 years old and had all of his youth in Madison, Wisconsin. So, but I have to say, back when I was looking for child care there, it was scary and it wasn't easy. There are, again, you know, some good options, but it's difficult everywhere, even in places like Madison.
Let's go back to politics for a moment. You talk about how far behind we are where we have not had a woman as head of state. Let's talk a little bit about Hillary Clinton, now the first woman in this country to be nominated by a major party. What difference does it make, either in terms of moving women ahead in some of the areas that we have mentioned, and there are many more, to giving young women inspiration to enter politics? Does it mean anything or not?
It certainly does mean something. And, you know, set aside for the moment whatever one's views might be of that particular candidate, and we can certainly talk about that, and particularly what Hillary Clinton has done in that area and what she plans to do. But, you know, translate to anything else. Let's say back when we had never had an African-American as a president, imagine if we had, you know, never had someone of one of the major religions, if we had never had somebody who grew up as a working-class person. We're in a democracy, and women constitute more than half of our population. They have been voting for a century. What does it mean that women who come in all sizes and shapes, all religions, all walks of life, all classes, all everything, that never in the century that they have been able to vote, has one managed to become head of state? It is a sign of democracy. You know, then add to that the issues of policy and so forth, but it's there's a barrier there, and we have to ask, how proud are we of having a barrier that means this has never happened?
Mm-hmm.
I have a friend in England I was talking to recently, and again, you know, the woman they had as prime minister isn't exactly like Hillary Clinton. She's from a different kind of party, but this friend of mine from England said, my goodness, isn't it about time you joined the rest of the democracies of the world?
Mm-hmm. And she certainly has made women's issues, child care, women's empowerment, a central part of her life, actually.
She always has. You know, you look at her first jobs where, you know, her first major work, other than, you know, some of the things she had done as a lawyer, was to work for the Children's Defense Fund. And so family and child policy, especially oriented toward children, and you can't talk about the care of children without talking about women. She was very involved in that at that time. If you look at the international conferences where she went, and she was a promoter of women's rights, a speaker on women's rights. I did some research on some things she did as First Lady. And one of the things I hadn't known that was really fascinating was she was often an emissary to especially Asia and to Africa, where she would go, and because her background, would go into villages and investigate the status and the rights of women and children and work with people to try to figure out how to improve the status of women and children. So that's a long-standing commitment of hers.
We welcome phone calls. There is a huge conference taking place, not getting a whole lot of attention. Maybe after everybody's met, there will be a lot of news on this, although there are other subjects dominating the news this week. The White House Council on Women and Girls, in collaboration with the State Department, Department of Labor, Aspen Institute, and Civic Nation, has brought together 5,000 people in Washington today. It is the first ever United States of Women Summit. The issues that are being discussed, and there are subcategories to each of these larger categories, economic empowerment, health and wellness, educational opportunity, violence against women, entrepreneurship and innovation, and leadership and civic engagement. We have touched on just a few of the areas. I'm interested in what your response is. Why is it that women vote in huge numbers? 62.3% of women voted in 2012, but when you look at Senate numbers, House numbers, gubernatorial positions, state legislators, you find only 25% in the Senate, 20% in the House, 12% of governors, 25% of state legislators. I thought it would be higher for state legislators, but indeed it is not. Does it make a difference to have women in political life? Does it make a difference to have a woman as the nominee of a major party for the first time in history? What are the symbolic implications here? What are the signs for young girls who may think they want to go into a life of politics to have somebody at the head of a ticket who is female? And why are there so few women? What kinds of issues do you think the Congress should address? What about these issues of this lingering equal pay problem that women are just not making what men are unless they don't have children, and still then they don't, but they make more money. The minimum wage issue, we can talk about that. Average minimum wage worker, 35-year-old woman who is working full-time. Paid sick leave, we don't have much of that. 44% of the workforce can't earn paid sick leave. 44%. Paid family leave, a problem. And there are a lot of issues that deal with other areas of women's lives. Violence, 1 in 5 women sexually assaulted while in college. Global health issues, the number of women, hundreds of thousands of women who die from complications during pregnancy and also childbirth. Early childhood education, community college, and many other issues. We'd love to hear your thoughts on all of these issues. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. And our guest is Professor Virginia Sapiro. She's a professor of political science at Boston University, and she also is a former UW-Madison professor. To you momentarily, I'm Kathleen Dunn. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 800-486-8655 is our number, and let's start our phone calls with Steve in Hayward. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Kathleen. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm obviously a guy, and I agree with that equality between the sexes in our society is a desirable thing. It should have happened long ago. It continues to amaze me that with women being the major, there are more women in the country than there are men, why we can't get women to vote their own interest as a group. It's been this way for a long time. And I would suggest that maybe that's a way to approach the problem, is to get women to stand up for themselves more.
And when you say to vote their own interest, can you be a little more specific? Are you talking about specific candidates that women endorsed who didn't have women's interests at heart, or what?
Yeah, I think, for instance, in the upcoming election, it's going to be really interesting to see. I mean, you have kind of a stark choice between somebody who believes in the value of women as equal partners in our society and somebody who is questionable on that one at best. It'll be interesting to see where the women's vote goes.
And so,
I don't know how you get women to vote for those candidates for whom these issues are important, but it seems to me that would be a way to begin to approach the problem. Women need to get together and decide, you know, let's give people a score on women's issues and make sure women all know this.
Professor Shapiro, what do you say?
I think it's a great and perennial question. The problem we have that you asked, Kathleen, is what do we mean by women's interests, which is another thing that's been debated a lot. And women are as diverse and various as men are. So that while there are certainly a lot of women who would agree with what the caller said and the implications, I mean, having gone on to say that we have this stark contrast and one's kind of, you know, in favor of women's interests and the other seems to be off in another direction, because women are as diverse as men, and we have women who are extremely conservative, women who are, very concerned with religious issues, women who, you know, hate taxation, women who like guns, women who all sorts of different things. It means that, first of all, it's hard for a lot of people to see what a common core of women's interests are, although, you know, there are a lot of us who have some ideas that have to do with some of the things we've been talking about. But then there are differences in the view of the solutions. So you might take, say, a progressive Democrat who would see some of the solutions in the direction that I think that we were kind of discussing, that you need support for child care and parental leave and you need more action against violence against women. But you have some people who would argue that, no, those are entitlements, and what you need to have is a really good, strong economy, and that alone will lift all boats. So, you know, I think that's the problem, is that, or the issue in any case, that in this democracy we're really various. The other thing is, even if women see some of these women's issues, as we might call them, as important, do they see them as the most important, or do they vote on other means? And it's clear that a lot of women see other issues as perhaps more important than those.
So does that mean that if we had better representation of women in office, we wouldn't necessarily have more action on wage disparity, minimum wage, family leave, sick leave, et cetera?
If we had better representation, we are more likely to see some of that, because for the women who care about those things, it's a higher priority than for a lot of the male leaders who care about those things. And so they will be raised and they will be discussed. They're more likely to be raised and discussed. And that's what we've seen in legislatures. Again, I mentioned corporate boards and C-suites earlier, that these issues at the corporate level are more likely to be at least raised and discussed and treated seriously if there are women there. So, you know, I think we would make more progress if we had more women. But at the same time, we have a two-party system where, at least for those people who have been in the core of their parties, the two major parties have had really different stands on a lot of these issues, and we've tended to make more progress on some of those policy areas with one party than the other.
Thanks, Steve, for your call. Joy in Eagle, hi.
Hi, this is Joy.
Hi, Joy.
I just wanted to respond to one of the previous callers, Steve, saying that women needed to be more involved in this. I do agree wholeheartedly with that, but, you know, men also need to support women's issues because they have a lot to gain from the fact that their wife or their partner can have paid medical leave, mm-hmm. Or paid maternity leave. And back in the 1980s, I was part of a class action suit against my employer a national major employer that did not provide maternity leave, and we won that. So women need to get on this bandwagon, but it's not just we can't, you know, men need to support us. And I'm sorry I just brought groceries in, so I'm winded.
It's okay. No, it's fine. What do you have? What do you have for dinner?
Chicken.
All right. My kind of meal.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Joy.
Caller's absolutely right. And,
yes.
You know, fortunately, there have been men at all levels. I mean, obviously, no legislation has passed any legislature or the U.S. Congress without the support of men. So to the degree that there have been changes, that's been important. Some of our most important changes in women's rights and opportunities have taken place, for example, through the Supreme Court, which was absolutely critical in getting as far as we did in the interpretation of equal pay legislation and the interpretation of equal job opportunities, not to mention, of course, reproductive rights. And those courts have not had a majority of women. They have had a majority of men. So it's clear that this is something that has to happen with men and women working together for the good of society and all our members and certainly our children.
What's your sense, getting back to the election of 2016, what's your sense of the role women will play in this election?
Well, it's critical because women are a majority of the voters, and women turn out very strongly in all social groups, but especially among white voters, African American voters, and I think these days also among Latino voters. The women really tend to turn out. We have seen in the primaries thus far some really important gender dynamics. So. In the support of the candidates, certainly on the Democratic side, we've seen a gender gap in nearly every primary and caucus, where in most cases, women were more likely to support Hillary Clinton, men more likely than women to support Bernie Sanders. In some cases, it's even a majority of men support Sanders, a majority of women support Clinton, and so it depends on how much they turn out. We are seeing in the polls now about Trump and Clinton, some of those same kind of dynamics. So gender will make a big difference, but it's not just women who are attracted to women's issues or don't want to be insulted by Donald Trump. It's also a lot of certain kinds of men who really find Donald Trump certain white men, middle-class white men who find Trump's appeals, especially against PC and against immigrants and so forth, very attractive. So it's going to be interesting.
It's going to be nasty, isn't it? It already is.
Oh, my goodness. Mm-hmm. Well, it's already nasty, and I'd say all of us should go out there and get some really good hip boots.
Plus, we have all these horrendous issues we're dealing with. It's just a really hard time, I think, in this country, don't you?
It is a hard time. I think one of the things that is very difficult, it's not the first time in our history, but the decline of civility.
Yes.
That we see. We have more capability right now, I think, of being uncivil to each other. And all you have to do is look at the blogs and the posts that come up. You know, in any newspaper or anywhere else, it seems to me that if you read an article or look at a post, and then you see the comment section, it normally only takes two or three people, often under cover of a pseudonym, to start being really nasty and personal attacks,
right,
and disgusting attacks, and a lot of the things most of us don't even see. There's a lot going on out there right now, which is much more racist and homophobic, anti-Semitic than most of us could tolerate within 3 hours of eating a meal. And, you know, something about social media, which means people can just blast off anytime they want. They can do it under cover of a pseudonym, and they can find the other four people who are equally nasty and feel like they have a good club.
Joy, thanks very much for your call. And let's go to Marty in Elkhorn. Hi, Marty.
Hi, Marty. Hi, Kathleen. Hi, Patricia. You know, I'm gonna posit that women are secondary to men in large part due to religion. And I'm going to clarify that. I was born Catholic, and I was taught that Eve tempted Adam with the apple, and he took a bite out of it, and therefore she gets short shrift for doing this. And I always thought to myself, you know, it's not like she stood on his chest, you know, and forced it down his throat. Why isn't he equally guilty? And then if you look over at Indian countries, you know, the woman is supposed to walk 10, 15 feet behind the man. They're supposed to drape their bodies completely in clothing. And I just can't help but think that that is the covert reason why women get paid less, why they are viewed as sexual objects and not as human beings, why they don't get the thought of, you know, having some expenses paid and stay at home and rear your child. And on a final note, you know, I wonder if the countries that offer child leave and take care or have thoughts about the woman's efforts and concern and health, are they not more secular on the whole than they are religious? And I'll listen to your answers off
air.
Thank
you, Marty. Thanks for the call.
Thank you. I like your line. It is time for Adam to take some responsibility for himself, which also reminds us of discussions that have to do with sexual violence and so forth. Responsibility is an important thing. I think traditionally there was a tie between religious views that permeated societies and so forth, but in most of our societies, there's some where that's still obviously very, very crucial, but in most of our societies, including ours, that's loosened up a lot. I mean, we have over two centuries of a U.S. Constitution and the rule of law, which in a diverse country, you know, says that there's justice and there's equality, and we've moved past that. I think it depends on what religious views you're talking about. There are religions where people have a view that women's role is to be subservient. But churches have also been very much in the leadership of arguing for justice and arguing for equality. And some of the major traditional religions where from the pulpit there has just been a tremendous push and leadership for there to be equality. So I think religion has had a major role in different directions.
Mm-hmm. But it really has only been within the last 20 years or so that many major Christian denominations have allowed women to be at the highest level of leadership in churches. And the Catholic Church certainly hasn't done that yet.
Sure. Except, you know, it depends on what you're talking about. Are you talking about, you know, the Unitarians or the more liberal Baptists or, you know, the more liberal Jews? Or are you talking about the more conservative ones? You know, the Catholic Church, yes, has a limitation. The Mormons, yes, have limitations as well in race. But even if you go back to the 19th century, some of the most important leaders of abolition, anti-slavery, women's rights, were ministers, were associated with the Quakers, were associated with the Unitarians, were associated with the Congregationalists. Some of the major groups now have included Episcopalians and others. So it's recent, but a lot of stuff's recent.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Lynn in Eau Claire next. Hi, Lynn.
Hi, Kathleen. We may have been a country for 200 plus years, but we've come from traditional families for a lot longer. And it seems to me, and this is only my opinion, that sometimes women have to take on what would be called male attributes, you know, sports type attributes, become more outspoken, more violent towards each other to make it in the world of politics. And it's confusing. It's very confusing. Time to raise our daughters and our granddaughters and to be yourselves, but you're not good enough as yourself. You have to take on male attributes to to become successful.
More violent, did you say? Women are becoming more violent?
I believe so, yeah. In their speech, in the way that we deal with each other. I saw a film, Five Broken Cameras, and to see Israeli women rifles, this is just one, at children, is it's something as, you know, my role has been as a wife and a mother. And it was, I couldn't wrap my head around picking up arms against someone. And then we had Maggie Thatcher, and it confuses me.
Professor Shapiro.
It is confusing to people, and we still have a lot of this of kind of cultural lag. And, you know, we have to piece apart what kind of human attributes, because I actually don't believe much in male and female attributes, because research shows that they vary across people, especially if they're left free, very widely. It depends on what you're talking about. Do men or women need to be violent to become leaders in education, in politics, in corporations? I don't think so. I mean, we don't have shooting matches, or shouldn't be having shooting matches in those areas. The issue of women in the military is a whole other issue. When women have had to, they have defended themselves and their families. We'd like to see women defending themselves more when they're attacked. But should women be in the military? Well, countries have been slowly moving to that point, including our own. You know, I'm from the generation where our fathers fought in World War II. And when I think back to the fathers I knew and tried to imagine a lot of them holding guns and shooting people in World War II, that's very hard. And there's a reason why we have so many male soldiers after World War I, certainly even after World War II, which we don't talk about, and then the more recent wars, where they suffer from PTSD because it's not part of their upbringing and their day-to-day life to do that, but they do when they're called on to go to war. And so we're talking about that for women. But strength, assertiveness, the ability to speak clearly in public, I don't see that as male. I see that as human.
More phone calls in just one moment. We're talking this hour about a little covered, maybe there will be news that will come from this, but there's a very large United States of Women Summit that's going on today at the White House. 5,000 people are attending, and they're looking at so many different topics. They're going to celebrate the progress that has been made on gender equity, but also look at the work that still needs to be done. Violence against women is one of the areas. Economic empowerment, leadership, civic engagement, women in political life, educational opportunities, child care, family leave, paid leave, minimum wage, taking on a whole host of issues that are of domestic concern and also international concern. Our phone number for you to join this conversation is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is Kathleen Dunn Show. Why is it that we don't have women represented in the way they reflect the U.S. population in all levels of government in this country? Why are we still trying to figure out how to get, or we're not figuring out how to get pay that's equal, female work, male work? Why is there still a pay gap, even though it's narrowed slightly? There are still policies and practices that perpetuate inequality. What about the minimum wage? More than half of minimum wage workers are women. Paid sick leave, big issues still. Family paid leave, huge issue in this country, because 90% of American workers don't have access to paid family leave, which makes it really rough. One of the reasons we're struggling economically. Violence, 1 in 5 women sexually assaulted while in college. What will this conference hope to address? We also are living in a time when we have the first female nominee from a major party in American history. What is the significance of that? More phone calls momentarily. Our guest this hour used to be a professor at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. Professor Virginia Sapiro is now professor of political science at Boston University, and she is with us this hour. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, our phone number, 800-486-8655. There are some issues, Professor Sapiro, that keeps surfacing, certainly that Stanford rape case that received so much attention in this country. Violence is another area that's being taken up today at the conference. 1 in 5 women sexually assaulted while in college is a huge problem on campuses, and we still have major issues of domestic violence, dating violence, sexual assault, and stalking. All of those will be taken up in Washington today as well.
It's true. I was talking with somebody the other day and about this, and, you know, some of the discussions of that horrific case at Stanford, where the young man and his father seemed to excuse what happened, and people saying, well, what was the woman doing drunk? I was asking a few of my male friends, what would you do if you saw a woman lying on the street, unconscious? And, you know, none of them said they'd think about whether they could rape her. What they said was, I'd call 911. I'd check to see she has a pulse. I'd see whether she needs hospitalization. I'd try to do something to help. And I think that's the normal reaction you'd expect and hope for. But seeing somebody unconscious just doesn't strike a lot of us as an excuse for raping them, murdering
right.
them, stealing their wallet, or anything else.
So why is this problem so large now?
It's no larger than it ever was.
Really?
The problem is that we haven't ever really dealt with it adequately. The issues on campuses were sort of left to their own to deal with it among themselves, and I think there was always a kind of view that, first of all, universities and colleges aren't equipped to do the full judicial process that that courts and police are equipped to do, but also there has always been a view that, well, among young people on campus, things happen and you don't want to wreck their lives, and so you try to deal with it and mediate, which means mostly that in the end women have been hurt by this. But the broader culture, there is still a view that men should be able to try to get what they can from women sexually, that if people are drinking, that makes it acceptable, that if women wear certain clothes or drink or do other things, that they deserve to be hurt.
More phone calls. Todd in Appleton. Hi.
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 I had a question, actually a comment on a comment earlier on men going to war and women being in the military. I retired from the Army in 1991. I was in military police and before that military intelligence. But I was around when the Women's Army Corps was all but dissolved and they were distributed throughout the Army except the combat arms. Being in military police, we got the lion's share of young ladies coming into our unit, and they made a very good impression. They did their jobs very well. There was a lot of discrimination at first, but I think what happened as the time went on was that we started to get some graduating female officers from ROTC programs and other non-commissioned officers, women who were in leadership positions now, and setting the example for the other ladies coming in. I think that made a big difference, but I have no qualms about serving with them. And to me, I think a lot of civilians misunderstand what, you know, combat is, as combat arms is, in that if you're being shot at, you're in combat. You might be a clerk typist. You might not be in the infantry, but you're being shot at. And there have been nothing but positive reports about women soldiers in a situation that's been in a crisis situation that have done very well. In fact, if they are in police departments, they can certainly be soldiers.
Thank you, Todd. Professor Sapiro.
Those are great comments and goes along with so much that I've heard from so many people, including leadership people in the military, and especially your comment that of people not understanding combat. We've thought for a long time it would be perfectly fine for women to be, you know, in medical corps and be nurses. That doesn't happen, you know, miles and miles and miles away from the battles that are going on, and certainly when nursing and the military started during the Civil War in the 19th century, women have always been hurt by being part of that and trying to serve their country. So I think the issue that many people are facing is what we need is the best trained military we can possibly have, bring in the best people, train them very well, make sure they can do their job, and we want that to happen regardless of whether they're men or women.
We go to Ann in Green Bay. Hi, Ann.
Hello. You had asked about why there's not as many women in the political arena, and I think a lot of it has to do with funding. I mean, the major funding comes from the Good Old Boy Network, so until we change the way campaigns are funded and the amounts of money that a person needs to raise, I don't think it's ever going to change.
Did you ever want to run for office, Ann?
No, I don't have that kind of money.
But if you had that kind of money, if somebody courted you and gave you access to funds, it would be of interest to you?
It would.
I think the money issue is certainly very important. But women have been involved in that for quite a while. There were a number of years where if you look at the amount of money that various PACs and bundlers were bringing in, there was a time when Emily's List was the largest of all, even bigger than the Realtors. And so they were bringing in a fair amount of money. But it is hard, and it does speak to who what does it take? Who are the people who give all that money, willing to support? And in the post-Citizens United period, where we have these large organizations where we mostly don't know who it is and who's bundling the money and where it's going, it's hard to know, and it's hard for women to attract that money. The state where I actually vote is New Hampshire, and right now we are going to have a major and probably super expensive Senate race between the current sitting senator, Kelly Ayotte, who is a Republican and a woman, and the current governor, Maggie Hassan, who is a Democrat and a woman. You better believe that one is going to bring in just tons of money, and it's two women.
It is hard to imagine anybody thinking that they could run for office because of the amount of money. It would immediately make you think, oh, come on, this is way too expensive. I don't want to spend all this time trying to court money.
Well, being in politics is courting money. You don't have to be rich yourself. Most of these people are not wealthy themselves, but you have to be able to get the right kind of backing, and you have to be willing to be able to do fundraising. And I think some women say that's the part that's more difficult, is can you look somebody in the eye and say, I believe in this, I'm good at this, and I want you to support me,
right,
and I want you to take out your credit card.
I know. Will you give me money? Huh?
Oh, not that way. It's, please give me money because I'm worth it.
Yeah, I gotcha.
But you know, women are a huge number of the people who are philanthropy development people.
Yes.
Who ask for money, so we sure know how to do it.
Yes, you're right. Thank you so much, Professor Shapiro, for covering a wide range of issues. I'll be interested to see what comes from this conference, and I'm glad we know about it now.
Thank you. I enjoyed it very much.
Our guest this hour, Professor Virginia Shapiro. She's a professor of political science at Boston University. She's a former UW-Madison professor. And we're talking about the summit taking place today. It's big, 5,000 people on the first ever United State of Women. Thanks to Chris Molina for finding out about this summit. And thanks for him producing the show. And KP Whaley for all his on-air production work here today. Thanks for your calls, everybody. A time when young people voted in huge numbers. Hour two.